What's the function of a political system? Well, it fulfills several different significant functions. It can articulate the demands of society, maybe not perfectly, but it does. It ends up selecting the people who fill positions of power, positions of responsibility, and very imperfectly provides them with some clues as to what kind of public policy they should adopt and what kind of public policy they should follow. Anybody lost, confused, strayed, or stolen at that point? Now, there are some things that change in a political system and some things that don't. The physical circumstances don't change a lot. Guess what? In the 51 years I've been teaching the course, what do you think has changed in the physical elements that we talked about at the beginning of the semester? Is Texas any bigger or smaller than it was 50 years ago? No. Have the rainfall patterns changed significantly so that all of a sudden now East Texas is wet and West Texas is dry, or the other way around? No. Have the rivers changed their course? Not really. But the socioeconomic has changed, and changed rather significantly over the last 50 years. The legal part, the Constitution and the laws of the state of Texas, the laws have changed some, but not massively over the last 50 years. We already discussed the fact that the Constitution was outdated 50 years ago, and guess what? It's still outdated. Made an effort 40 years ago to change it. That was unsuccessful. I suspect your generation is going to have to deal with that. Ultimately, the Texas Constitution will have to be rewritten to take care of the fact that Texas is not in 1876, and the government that was sufficient for 1876 is probably not adequate in the middle of the 21st century. Economics. Any change in the economics of Texas the last 50 years? Is that about the stupidest question anybody ever asked? I think so. Good question. If the current slump in oil prices, if the Texas economy had not changed from where it was in the mid-70s and early 80s, and we had the price of oil drop from $100 a barrel down to about $40 a barrel, what would have happened to the Texas economy 40, 50 years ago? Well, we don't have to guess. It did. Remember the joke about the two things you couldn't find in Midland, Texas? A solvent bank and a U-Haul truck? Now, it's impacting Texas. It's impacting the Houston economy, particularly because Texas is oil city. But it's not leading to the overwhelming economic impact that it had 40 years ago due to diversification. Fair enough? Now, I suspect we will probably come to a point in time, and this is something that the politicians are ignoring at the present time, when the Texas economy probably can't rely as heavily on the oil and gas industry as it does today. Fortunately, we don't rely on it as much as we did in the 70s and 80s, but it still generates between 30 and 40% of all the economic activity in the state of Texas. If you can read the I can point you to some extremely good literature on that that's conducted by impartial agencies that deal with the work. So let's change gears for a second, talk a little bit about types of democratic systems. An elitist system is one in which there is a small group of people who essentially dominate the political, social, and economic system. A participatory system would be one where there was universal citizen participation, voting turnout would be close to 100%, etc. The perfect situation. We're in a transition phase. Back before the 1920s and 30s, Texas had a fairly elitist political system. And if you take a look at the politics, the political issues that took place, we had several reform movements. Governor Hogg in the late 1890s, Jim Ferguson, Pappy Leo Daniel, which were all basically reformist movements that didn't particularly pan out. But a system that was pretty much dominated by an economic, political, social elite, largely revolving around oil. More on that in a minute. Right now, most political scientists argue that we have a pluralistic system. This is one in which competition between interest groups is what basically creates public policy. Now, pluralism with excessive interest group involvement is called hyperpluralism. I'm not going to get too carried away on that, but I think you at least should be familiar with the term. Fair enough. Now, what is fascinating in Texas politics is you have two groups that are unhappy to some extent with the interest groups that tend to dominate Texas politics. And let's face it, the interest groups that dominate Texas politics are largely economic. The Tea Party movement is really a revolt against the existing political system. The progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which is largely, I'll use the word liberal, but I'm not sure that necessarily fits, approaches it from the other side. Interestingly enough, their complaints are about the same. There's a small handful of people who are dominating, a small handful of groups that are dominating the political system, and we're mad as hell and we won't take it anymore. Fair enough, play with that later. The political culture is a system of shared beliefs, shared values, and habits of behavior with regard to government and politics. And we'll take just a few seconds to talk about the derivation of Texas political culture. Many of these groups have a whole lot more in common than they think they do. Texas has been largely a conservative state. General hostility toward governmental activity, unless we can make that governmental activity work for us. That is to say, you will hear interest group spokesmen talking about excessive governmental regulation, and then in the next session of the legislature, they're up there working like mad to make sure that there is regulation, primarily of their competition, and that the regulation works in their favor. Are they talking out of both sides of their mouth? Yeah, really. But if they get really PO'd when you point that out. There's a big stress on individualism. Now the question obviously is those of you who've had federal government, what is individualism taken to its almost extreme in politics? What political philosophy? Anybody? Libertarianism. Libertarianism argues individuals ought to be allowed to do, which is one reason in the debates, the Republican debates, you had Rand Paul coming out on a very different position than the rest of the debaters or participants on the subject of regulation of something like marijuana. He comes from a libertarian background. His father, of course, was Ron Paul. A Republican by convenience, but ran as the libertarian candidate for president. Didn't do too well, but Rand is maybe not a chip off the old block, but at least a splinter. A belief in the free market economy, unless we don't like what the free market economy is doing to us, in which case we'll try to use our emphasis and our contact in government to make sure that it doesn't bite us in the rear. And then an emphasis on taxes, low taxes. Even when it becomes obvious that the pursuit of low taxes, sorry about that, the hearing aid moving around on me, even when it becomes obvious that the emphasis on low taxes means that you have less infrastructure than you absolutely need in order to maintain your economy. Now, some of the philosophers, some of the people who write about this, talk about pseudo laissez-faire economics. You believe in social Darwinism, that is, the survival of the fittest, but if we can bend the rules to help the business and the wealthy, we'll do it. So you have to ask the question when you're looking at the Texas legislature and you see some of the legislation coming out of it, is it truly conservative or is it pseudo-conservatism? Is it? But we play with that later. All right, not going to get too deep on this. There's several things that you don't want to have too deep. You don't want to get into political culture too deeply, and you don't want to start having to wade up to your hip in a swamp. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference. Kathy, we're glad to have you back. I got your paper for you. Or no, we don't. Yeah, we do. Okay. Who can vote? Well, let's take a little history on this. The U.S. Constitution does not grant anyone specifically the right to vote. Does that confuse anybody? U.S. Constitution basically left voting up to the states. But we have amended the U.S. Constitution four times. By the way, that is the most, that ties for the second most amendments on a particular topic in the Constitution. We've amended the Constitution four times. The first one was the 15th Amendment to say that states may not use race as a precondition or as a qualifying provision. Then we adopted the 19th Amendment, which fascinatingly enough was adopted in 1919. It said that gender cannot be used as a prerequisite or a disqualifier. Then we adopted the 24th Amendment because, as we're going to see, many of the southern states came up with ways to get around the 15th Amendment by imposing requirements that people have to pay a tax, particularly a poll tax, but other taxes as well, in order to vote. So the 24th Amendment took care of that. And then we adopted in the 1970s the 26th Amendment that says, and interestingly enough, it does not set the voting age at 18. It says that states may not set an age greater than 18 for a person to qualify to vote. Could we, if we wanted to, drop the voting age in Texas to say 15? Sure. 26th Amendment wouldn't oppose it. Now, the Texas Constitution sets up three categories of people who cannot vote. Mentally incompetent as judged by a court of law. Persons who have been convicted of felonies, although there is a methodology and a system by which persons can have their voting rights restored if they are felons. And Texas has one of the most forgiving procedures there. Florida is among the worst. You have to have a gubernatorial pardon in order to have your voting rights restored if you've ever been convicted of a felony in Florida. And that's under attack at the present time. Now, the third provision says that if you're a pauper, that is a person who's totally dependent upon the government, you can't vote. That is probably, we don't even try to enforce it in Texas. And it's probably unconstitutional. What part of the Constitution would it violate? The 14th Amendment. No state shall make or enforce any law which would deprive any person of due process of law, blah, blah, blah. Equal Protection Clause. All right, got a question for you. Can I pick on you for a second? Either you or Jessica, how about you both can team up on this. What was the basis of the Supreme Court's decision outlawing, or that is striking down state laws which prohibited persons of the same gender being married? Jessica?
I'm still trying to wake up.
You've got to wake up first. You're kind of like one of the computers that after it's gone into sleep mode, you got to hit the button a couple of times before it'll wake up.
Well, I'm going to say the same
14th Amendment. And there's some rather interesting debate between some of the... I think Mike Huckabee's almost attempted to turn himself inside and out to prove that the 14th Amendment not only didn't mean that, but the 14th Amendment itself was unconstitutional because it wasn't constitutionally adopted. I think if a student in one of my classes advanced that argument, they wouldn't make too many points on a test. Because there's no historical or legal precedent for that. All right, what are the legal qualifications to vote in Texas? 18 years of age, over 18, U.S. citizenship, and have resided in the state and county for 30 days. Now, the state of Texas also passed a law not too long ago with a rather stringent, in fact, the most stringent voter photo ID law in the country. It's currently being challenged in court, and the thing is working its way up to the Supreme Court. What do you think is the basis of the challenge?
I believe they're claiming that...
Is it a 14th Amendment issue? Well, it's kind of an interesting one. You take some different things from the Constitution, take different sections. Can you prove that it disproportionately impacts upon persons of color? Yes. Can you prove that it disproportionately affects people with low incomes? Yes. So, take your pick. Which provision of the Constitution do you want to challenge it on? It's getting interesting. Supreme Court in an Indiana case ruled that so long as the photo ID provision was not discriminatory, it was not unconstitutional. And many states, including Texas, jumped on that to pass their own legislation. But they probably, it's my personal opinion, identified as such, probably overreached. They probably did put themselves. That's the reason. Yes, ma'am.
In what way does it disproportionately affect persons of color and low income?
They're less likely to have cars, so the driver's license, which is the preferred instrument. They're less likely to be able to come up with the documents necessary to get the state ID, which costs money. There's even a point that I'm not sure that I buy the argument, that it is in effect the same thing as a poll tax, because you have to produce certain documents that cost money to get in order to get the ID.
But currently, in order to get a voter ID, all you need is a birth certificate, and the birth certificate for the voter ID is free.
If you have one. And not everybody has a birth certificate. And they will not take baptismal certificates, etc. It's estimated that 3-4% and a disproportionate percentage of persons of Hispanic background do not have what is required as a legal birth certificate. But again, that's all currently being thrashed out in the courts. Okay. The Indiana situation, the Indiana photo ID, was a lot more simple. And the Supreme Court said no problem with that. But Texas, for example, your college ID will not count in Texas. Whereas in Indiana, a college ID was perfect. No problem.
I believe the desire was to prove citizenship.
Say again?
I believe the intention was to prove citizenship as well as identity.
Interestingly enough, most of you could not prove that you're citizens of the United States. There's no one single document that proves American citizenship. In most European countries, there is an identity card which proves your citizenship. And by the way, can also be used. Now, you talk about a very interesting thing. Anybody familiar with Mexico? Has anybody ever seen a Mexican voter registration card? What's on it? Now, it doesn't cost you anything to get one, does it?
I don't think so.
No. And you, the documents that you have to provide are fairly minimal. But the document itself, the voter registration card, has your picture and what else?
Your citizenship on it?
It has that listed. And what else? Your fingerprints.
Yeah, on the back of it.
I mean, talk about everything but a retinal scan, you know. I haven't figured out a way to do that yet. Wouldn't that be something? You go to the voter ID and say, okay, look into the thing. We'll do a retinal scan to make sure that you're truly who you say you are. Anyway, I'm not on the court, but the court is currently thrashing that out. So just keep your eyes open for it. It's being challenged both on a 14th Amendment and a 24th Amendment basis. And the district court in Texas did strike down the law, and it's on appeal to the Fifth Circuit. Registration procedures, how do you do it? In person. Actually, it's fairly easy to apply for a voter registration card in Texas. You can do it either in person or by mail. Your voter registration becomes effective the 31st day after your application was received. And here is a trick question. How long is it good for? Most people would say it's good for a year. That is not true. All voter registration cards expire on December the 31st of the odd-numbered year, regardless of when they were issued. Jessica, did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
You woke up now? So if you got one, this is almost October. You go down and file for voter registration, you will get one that will become effective 31 days from the time the application was received, so you could probably vote in the election in November. Now, we will, by the way, talk about the 7 constitutional amendments that will be on the ballot. What else will be on the ballot in November here in Galveston?
I believe there's a GISD school board election in one of the districts. There's something related to the GISD in one of the districts.
Could be. Galveston GISD has the board members elected on a 3-year basis. So we might have, and of course there's been very little discussion or publicity about that. So what do you think the voter turnout is going to be in November, if the only thing on the only thing are 7 constitutional amendments that nobody's heard of and which have not generated much publicity, and maybe uncontested board positions on the GISD, which may, though, by the way, if nobody else files, the election will be canceled and the person will be declared elected. We have a new provision in the Texas law that uncontested candidates don't have to hold an expensive election if it's an uncontested election, which means you're not going to have a write-in election. And only some elections you can do write-in candidates for. Now, it's automatically renewed unless you died or moved. Let's turn around and talk a little bit about the ideal conditions for an ideal democracy. Elections, campaigns, or contest, technically by opposing candidates, in which either the candidates debate issues on public policy rather than personal insults and negative campaigns. Voters vote on the basis of policy, and there's virtually universal participation. Do we meet all 3 of these conditions? Not by a long shot. How many of you happened to watch long extended press conference on CNN between the Republican candidates the last time around? Did it really constitute a debate? Like one long interview, and about maybe a third of the comments were candidates, one of the lesser candidates trying to figure out how to attack Donald Trump. Do voters always vote on the basis of policy issues? Well, we get perhaps a little more. Yeah. But as we're going to see, sometimes it's primarily voting on the matter of party identification, group affiliation, and not so much policy issues. And this is where we really bomb out, universal participation. Now, I happen to know, I hope I don't embarrass you, I think you have also worked as an election clerk, haven't you?
Every year since 2009.
Okay. Would it be fair to say that we have universal participation?
I think I actually looked it up, and the largest participation we've had was during a presidential year, and it was 30%.
Are there times when somebody walks through your door, through the door, and they go, of course, I was doing election clerk out in Precinct 223 at one point, and somebody walked through the door, and I thought, hot damn, a voter. And they said, can you tell me how to get to the bus stop? I think we had 12 people the whole day. Public elections now there's two kinds of elections, public elections and private elections. And this is going to make no sense, so hang with me. Public elections are held by a governmental body to decide on issues or to elect officials. And they can either be partisan or nonpartisan. I'll make life simple for you. There's only one partisan election in Texas, and that occurs on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of the even-numbered year, 2016. Fair enough? Only one partisan election. All of the other elections in Texas are technically nonpartisan, meaning candidates are not nominated by political parties. Got it? So she talked about the GISD election coming up maybe in November. Partisan or nonpartisan?
Nonpartisan.
Are the candidates identified by a political party on the ballot?
No.
Are they nominated by a political party? Now, in Houston right now, they have a mayor's election coming up, and it will be in November. Partisan or nonpartisan?
Partisan.
Is it the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of the even-numbered year?
No.
And does that automatically answer the question for you? Best I figure, 2015 is not an even-numbered year. Fair enough, Jessica? But is it possible that the candidates might be identified to some extent on a partisan basis?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. So you have to ask yourself the question when you're looking at the candidates, all right, which one of these is really the de facto Republican, and which of these is the de facto Libertarian, and which of these is the de facto Democrat, and which wing of the Democratic Party, and which wing of the Republican Party? But is that a particularly valid discriminatory basis? Can you discriminate on a valid basis that way? Not really. There might be two or three people who are quasi-Democrats and two or three people who are quasi-Republicans and some who are truly nonpartisan. And the political parties, which we'll talk about not today but later, may or may not take a position. Fair enough? Now, does this begin to sound confusing? What do you think? There's only two groups of people for whom this is not confusing. Those who are totally politically involved, and they can usually sort it out, and the people who are non-involved because they don't pay any attention one way or the other. Those are the only people who don't have any level of confusion about the situation. Now, how do you go about being the nominee of a political party? Well, interestingly enough, let's back up. There's three ways to get on the November general election partisan ballot. You can be the nominee of a legal political party. You can qualify as an independent candidate, or you can be a declared write-in. Everybody clear with that? That's the way you get on the ballot for the November general election. Now, how do you get on the ballot for the City of Houston election? We've already assessed that that is not a partisan election. Well, two of the three. You can be a qualified. Now, here's the thing. You're all independent candidates, right? Technically, you're all independent candidates in a nonpartisan election. It depends on the city charter as to whether you can have write-ins or not. Texas election law leaves that up to the cities to determine whether you can have write-in candidates or not have write-in candidates. Most do provide for write-in, but it's almost unheard of for somebody to declare a write-in candidate. Why? For city election or school board election or water district election. Almost never happens. Any idea why? Why go to the trouble to try to have your candidates, people write your name in when it doesn't cost you anything and it's extremely easy simply to qualify by filing? So in 99.9% of the cases for local and municipal elections, you just go ahead and file as a candidate so your name's on the ballot. Did that make sense to you? Everybody? If we were only trying to memorize this, would it make sense? I asked that question a time or two, a few semesters back, and the student said it doesn't make sense anyway. There's some truth to that. So who conducts the election, the general election? Well, either the county clerk or the county administrator, and the Texas Secretary of State supervises that, but the state of Texas forces the counties to pay the cost of the election. Now, I'm going to make a comment, and you can disagree with me if you want to. The state of Texas is the mother of all local governments, but she's a cheap mother. And as much as possible, they can kick the cost off to the local units rather than picking up the cost. They will do it. Now, the election coming up in this November is a nonpartisan election, right? Nobody's identified by party candidate. So you either file, and there's two kinds of those. Special elections, which are called to fill interim vacancies or decide on issues. And saw a headline in the paper yesterday, Houston Chronicle, where the city, Montgomery County, was going to hold a $240 million bond election. It was going to be a special election to be held at the same time as the uniform election date in November. But it turned out that there were some irregularities with the Montgomery County commissioners holding meetings with some special interest groups, but they never technically held those meetings because they never had a real quorum at any one time, but they were in communication by telephone, blah, blah, blah. You want to read that story. And if you call an election at an illegal meeting or as a result of an illegal meeting, is it a legal election? No. So it looks like they will not hold that election. But it was supposed to vote on a $240 million bond issue. Who pays for it?
Us.
The governmental entity that calls it. So the school board calls an election. Who pays for it?
The school board.
School board. Now, what complicates matters now? Got everybody's attention for a second? I know you're zoning out. This is an easy subject to zone out on, unless you're really, really into it. Do most school districts have voting machines and the other paraphernalia necessary to conduct an election? No. Back in the old days, and I'm old enough to remember when this was done, when they called an election like that, they'd get up, print up a bunch of ballots. I've still got one of those original ballot boxes. Actually, no, I don't. I donated it to the county museum that came from Highland School District. It was used in the early and mid-20th century. No, metal ballot boxes that people dropped their ballots into and they would then counted them. Do we do any of those paper ballots now? No. So who has the equipment?
Government.
County. Can cities and school districts afford to buy that expensive equipment and have the people who know how to program it and the people who know how to use it? No. So they contract with the county to, in effect, either one, conduct the election for them, or to provide the equipment which the district then uses. We don't have any of that in Galveston County. The county does not loan its equipment to local units of government. So for all practical purposes, it is the county that's conducting it, but the entity that's paying for it. And if you can have a combined election where the county, the city, the school district, the junior college district, the water district, they all just pick up their share of the cost rather than having to pick up the whole cost of the election total. Make sense to you folks? Now, I can remember when we would have elections seem like every other week. School district would hold one, the city would hold one, and finally the legislature said enough is enough. All local elections will be held on uniform election dates unless it's a special election. If it's a regular general election, it's going to be held on the second Saturday in May or on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November in the odd-numbered year. So how many times a year can we hold general elections for local units of government, nonpartisan elections? Twice. One in May, one in November. Okay, now where's the complication in even-numbered years?
Primaries.
No. Primary, we haven't talked about primaries yet. With very few exceptions, the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of the even-numbered year is the general election. And nothing can appear on the general election ballot other than the nominees that have been presented or issues that have been put forth by the Texas legislature unless special legislation has been passed to enable it. So far, so good? If you vote in Galveston, when you go down to vote on the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November of the even-numbered year, there will be candidates from the Navigation District number one in Galveston, because special legislation was passed a number of years ago to permit the commissioners who are being elected to the Galveston County Navigation District number one. What does that Galveston County Navigation District number one do? Now, choking it up. I'm getting ahead of myself just a little bit, okay? I don't expect you to really know this. Most people would, if you ask them that question, they say, well, they run the Port of Galveston. No, actually they don't. Port of Galveston is run by basically the city of Galveston and has no taxing authority. Anna, you may be the only one in here who have a clue.
I don't know. Sorry.
All right. We're batting 100%. I guess if you count me out, you know. They do the Pelican Island Bridge. They're responsible for the building and maintenance of the Pelican Island Bridge. But they have such a limited little tax base that although that bridge needs to be replaced by a bigger, better structure without a draw on it, it ain't no money. And there's all sorts of debate and discussion right now about how to go about replacing the Pelican Island Bridge. It's outmoded, it's outdated, it had to do some extensive repairs just to make it safe. But with the growth both of Texas A&M Galveston and the various industrial activities that are taking place over on Pelican Island, it needs to be replaced. Anyway, we'll play with that later. Anybody lost, confused, strayed, or stolen? Is it getting too deep? Is this the swamp getting deep? So far, so good. How about this side of the room? Swamp getting too deep for you? Okay. Can I pick on you?
Sure.
What's a plurality?
I don't know.
I don't know is a perfectly legitimate answer. Those are the three words that are beginning of knowledge. To admit you don't know something means that you can learn. The only people I ever have really have a problem with are the ones who don't know and won't admit it. I don't know, but damn, I've got an opinion. All right, back to the story at hand. It's the most votes. Let me back up. Last time we looked at the demographics of Texas, right? Is there a majority racial or ethnic group in Texas now?
No.
Now that one you should know.
Yeah.
Is there a group that has 50% plus one?
Yes.
Nope. Anglos are the biggest group. They're the plurality. At 47% in the 2010 census. And the next biggest group, Hispanics, and by 2030, which group will have for sure the plurality and probably majority?
Hispanics.
Hispanics. Do the words make sense to you now? All right, so if we talk about it being a plurality election, what does that mean? Whoever gets the most votes, wins. If there's three candidates and one gets 42%, let's go back to election before last. Rick Perry won a plurality of votes. But he was elected governor of Texas with 39% of the vote. That's a plurality. The November general election is a plurality election. We don't have a runoff. So far, so good. But if it's a majority election, then if nobody gets a majority, you have to have a runoff between the two top vote getters to determine who won. Make sense to you? If you only got 48% of the vote in a majority vote election, you didn't win. If you got 48% of the vote and the next candidate down got 43% of the vote in a plurality election, you won. Everybody comfortable with that? Yes? When we get to local government here in Galveston, we'll just kind of do a look at which elections are plurality elections and which are majority vote elections. Does it matter? Oh, it could if you happen to have polled the most votes with 49% of the vote and it's a majority vote election. And now you've got to run again. Take a break for just a second and tell you a story. In 1980, I was approached to run for county Democratic chairman because the then county Democratic chairman, Charlie Delgado, wanted to step down. And I was assured that probably there would be no problem one way or the other. So you teach government politics, you probably would be able to do that. So I thought, okay, I'll do it. On the filing day, you have to file. On the filing day, I discovered I had two opponents. They both came in at the last moment. People I knew pretty well. Actually, friends of mine. We just differed. They just happened to have thought maybe they'd like to be county chairman too. Jimmy Dimitri and Rose Mayos. Well, I could either do one of two things. I could pull out and violate my pledge to the people who had asked me to run, or I could hunker down and run a campaign. Now, what's involved if you're going to run the campaign? You got to raise money. You got to get out and meet people. Now, I thought I was pretty well known, but you know, I'd only been in Galveston about 11 years, and mostly I'd known students and teachers and so forth. Kathy, can I pick on you for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. She's going to say, no! You know what the hardest thing in politics to do is?
No.
I want to show you. Hi. I'm Bujo Waddell, and I'm running for County Democratic Chairman, and I would like your vote if you plan to vote in the Democratic primary next month.
No.
And you get that. You get that. That is the hardest thing in the world to do. Anybody can put up signs, anybody can go raise money, anybody can buy ads. But walking up to people that you've never met, introducing yourself and saying hi, identify yourself, tell them what you're doing, and ask them for their vote. That is difficult. I know. Been there, done that. And guess what? That night, had I won the election? No, because it was a majority vote election. Jimmy Dimitri had come in with slightly more votes than myself. Now, I didn't have anything against Jimmy. He's a good friend. But Jimmy would have had a hard time organizing a 3-car funeral. I just could not see that he would necessarily provide much leadership. He was a good, strong, he was a good, strong union member. He'd been well known in Democratic Party circles. He had been a precinct chairman for God forever. But everybody pretty well agreed that his organizational skills boil down to selling bumper stickers. So I had to go talk to Rose Mayos. She ran third. Now, I had not criticized either Rose or Jimmy in the campaign, had run a totally non-negative campaign. So when you do that, can you approach the third person and ask them for their support? And I did. And Rose came out and endorsed me. Well, to make a long story short, I won in the runoff election. Who votes in runoff elections?
Very few people.
So it becomes a matter of getting your troops to the polls and converting a few of Rose's. Now, I was elected county chairman for 10 years in Galveston County, served longer as county chairman in Galveston than anybody has ever served before or since, probably because I was just too dumb to quit. Truth of the matter. I don't know, it was fun. A lot of work, but fun. I never lost an election after that. I never lost more than 30% of the vote from that point on. I think my best shot was about 80-something percent. But how do you do that? Well, we'll play with that later on. Keep moving. Okay, enough of a break. Now, there's two kinds of elections. There's at-large elections and district elections. That is, all of the voters vote on all the positions to be filled. And you generally designate them by place or position. The Galveston College Board of Regents is an at-large election. All 9 members of the Galveston College Board of Regents are elected by all of the voters in the Galveston College District. Okay? Which, by the way, is coterminous with the boundaries of GISD. And they're designated position 1, position 2, position 3. 3 of the positions are up every 2 years. So you have a 6-year term. Is that true for members of the Texas legislature? No. They each have a district. And only the voters who live in the candidate's district can vote. Now, GISD and the Galveston City Council are district elections. What does that mean?
Nonpartisan.
What does that mean?
I don't know.
Can I vote, if I live on the West End, can I vote on a candidate running for the Galveston Independent School District if he lives in the East End?
No.
No. If I live in the West End, can I vote on a city council person whose district is the East End?
Yes. Mm-mm.
No.
West and East?
I can only vote on the person whose district I live in. Now, City of Galveston has what's known as a 6-1, one at-large position and six districts. What's the at-large position?
No idea.
It's not fair for me to ask you that because you've dealt with it. But if nobody else can jump up, we'll pick you in.
The mayor.
The mayor. Now, in fact, the mayor has no real responsibilities other than presiding and voting like he was a regular member of the city council. Fair enough? Because this is a council manager system, but we'll play with that later in the semester. All right, we're going to run out of time, so I got to get this dog and pony show to going. On an office column ballot, candidates are listed strictly by the office they seek. No indication of party affiliation. In nonpartisan elections, that's the way it's going to be. Our party column ballot, where the candidates are listed by political party and the office they're seeking. Will we have a party column ballot for any election this November? Nope. Easy enough. Partisan election is the only election in which you have a party column ballot. Anybody lost, confused, straight, or stolen on that?
Partisan,
now, Jessica, I'm going to throw a curve at you. There's a couple of representatives who resigned their office, state representatives who resigned their office. And they're going to have a special election to fill their seat this November. Will it be an office column or a party column ballot?
Office?
Yes! Now, how do you know that?
Can I read the description?
But they're running. They're normally representatives are elected on a party column ballot, aren't they?
Yeah, but.
But this is a special election. It's a nonpartisan election. Got it? And so there are a number of candidates who have filed, and they're all going, okay, now who is really the Republican nominee, and who's the Tea Party candidate nominee, and who's the Democratic Party candidate, you know. But when you get to the polling place, there will be no indication on the ballot of that. If you haven't done your homework, not a funny story, but it's true. We had one of those kinds of an elections here in Galveston, and this lady came up to me, and she said, I'm confused. Well, that was obvious. She said, which one of these is the Democratic candidate? Could I tell her? It's a violation of your oath as a election judge. You will not. And she got real PO'd with me. I said, ma'am, I can't tell you that. All right, we've been there, done that. All right. If party primary is the way one gets nominated in most instances for a partisan election, then the question is, what's a primary? Now, when we look at political parties, and we'll do that in a minute, that's another class. There's two types of political parties in Texas, major parties and minor parties. What's the difference? Well, the key determinant is how many votes they got for their candidate for governor in the last election. If you got more than 20% of the vote for your candidate for governor in the last election, you are declared by law to be a major party, and you must use a party primary to nominate your candidates. If you have less than 20%, then you can nominate your candidate any legal means, and most of them tend to go the convention route. So the Libertarians and the Greens may or may not have candidates on the ballot in November of 2018. Why not 2016? Well, for governor. We elect the governor on 4-year term. The last governor's election was 2014, right? So we won't have another governor's election until 2018. We will have a presidential election. Can minor parties put candidates on the ballot for the presidency? Yes. And the Libertarians and the Greens probably will. Will they have to hold primaries? No, they're really safe on this. They didn't run any candidates for governor. Therefore, they couldn't have gotten 20%. Therefore, they're by definition going to be minor parties, right? The parties, or major parties, are required to hold primaries on the first Tuesday in March with a runoff on the second Tuesday in April. You qualify by either paying a filing fee or getting enough signatures on a petition. If you get the signatures, you don't have to pay the filing fee. If you pay the filing fee, you don't have to pay If you pay the filing fee, you don't have to get the petition. Now, the state of Texas, the only election, this is a trick question. It's totally tricky because I'll let you know it's a trick question. The only election the state of Texas picks up the tab for are primaries. All other elections, the county or the city or the school district have to pay for them. But the state pays the cost of primaries. Long story, we don't have time to go into why. Fair enough? The filing fees only amount to a small percentage of the cost of conducting the election. All right, let's take a look at voter turnout for a second. This is 2008. I need to sit down and do it for 2014. It's not significantly different, to be honest about it. It just takes, it's a real pain in the rear to have to type all these statistics in and have it create the chart. Well, the good news is we're not number one, negatively speaking. But there are something like 46 other states that have higher turnout in presidential elections than Texas. Now, what do we attribute that to? Well, there's a whole bunch of things we can play with. National turnout, 60 to 63% in Texas. I got good news. It was better in 2008 than it was in 2004, but it's still not overwhelming. Now, there's two ways to register. There's two ways to consider turnout, and I almost hate to do this, particularly at the end of the class period, because people are already numb. VAP and VAR. VAP stands for voting age population. And VAR stands for voting age registered. Is everybody registered in Texas? No. Out of 24 million people, we have something like about 14 or 15 million people registered. About half, probably about 60-something percent of the adult eligible population. If we measure voter turnout as a percentage of those who are registered, Texas doesn't look bad. But if we do it as a percentage of those who could vote, that's where we're kind of down at the bottom of the barrel. Now, here's the problem. To be very nice about it, the Census Bureau does not ask whether the person that they're counting is eligible to vote. So what would tend to significantly impact upon those on those figures for Texas? Do we have a large immigrant population in Texas that may not be legally eligible to vote? But if we do VAP, are they included in the figure? Voting age population, not voting eligible population. Everybody with me on that? It is estimated that there are at least 2.5 to 3 million Texans who are over the age of 18 who are not eligible to vote due to their citizenship status. Then we have another big chunk of people who are not eligible to vote because Texas has incarcerated, put in jail, felonies, Well, the good news is we're not the worst in the country. The bad news is we're tied for the bottom quartile in terms of the total percentage of people who've been convicted of felonies and therefore haven't had their voter registration rights restored. So you put them together between the not necessarily illegal. They can be totally legal but still not be citizens. Okay? Between the non-eligible immigrant population and the non-eligible ex-felon population, you got a pretty good chunk of the voting age population. Ms. Blackwell, does that make sense to you?
Yes.
Everybody comfortable with that? Yes? No?
Maybe so.
You know, I can live with yes, I can live with no. I don't live with... November 2010, this is VEP, voting eligible population. VAP, voting age population. VEP, voting eligible population. It's still not good. Massachusetts, for example, has just slightly less than 50%. We come in at about 32%. How do you explain that? Well, and this is eligible. If you really want to have fun, sit down and play with this chart. I'm not going to spend a lot of time with it. But let me go back for just answer that question, and then we're about to wrap it up. One last slide, and we'll wrap this one up today. When we looked at the socio-demographic data for Texas, remember that? I don't expect you to memorize percentages. But how do we rank educationally compared with the rest of the country?
Pretty low.
Okay, pretty low is a nice, general, and accurate statement. We're just right below the midpoint, that would be pretty low. Or in the bottom quartile.
Bottom quartile.
Bottom quartile. Is there any evidence that educational status and voting participation are highly related? Or to use statistical terms, highly correlated? What do you think?
Probably.
Do educated people who have high school diploma or better, have a much better percentage voter rate than people who do not? Let's just rank them. Illiterates, almost at the bottom. Grade school only, next category. High school, next category. College education, next category. Graduate degrees, next category. Is it economically linked? If we looked at quartiles, or deciles actually, take deciles, or would the voting participation rates be closely related to the education, to the income bracket? Do wealthy people tend to vote more heavily than do low-income people? Very muchly so. You can find instances where there's exceptions to that. Millionaires who don't vote because they can buy the politicians and don't need to vote. And poor people who vote all the time. But if we do the overall correlation, there is a strong correlation between education and voting and income status and voting. Do you remember our discussion on Texas economic distribution, wealth distribution in Texas? Just a little bit vaguely. What's the key thing I ask you to take away from that? Of the 10 major urban states, which of the 10 major urban states has the largest number of people at the lowest income bracket?
Was it Illinois? Texas?
Does education correlate with that income generally?
Yeah.
Very, very definitely. So if we rank in the bottom quartile education, would it be any surprise that we rank in the bottom quartile
income.
On income?
Yeah.
So when you have correlated income, education, and they're correlated factors, it really helps you and explain why our voting participation rates are so low. Okay? Now, don't ever, 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 one of the students put on a test, Texas has more dumb people and therefore they don't vote. Educational status and being smart or dumb don't necessarily correlate. I've met some very dumb, well-educated people. I've met some very dumb, very wealthy people too. We got 1 minute. I'm going to tell you a quick story and then we'll come back and talk about the trends. We don't really have time for it in a minute. One of the smartest men I ever met had never been to school in his life but for one day. We used to own a piece of property up on the Trinity River, down in the river bottoms, and there was a commercial fisherman there by the name of Otis Lanning. Otis had come from a very poor family. He was about 9 years old before he went to the first grade the first time. He had raggedy clothes. He didn't have any shoes. And they made fun of him, so he never went back. He couldn't read. He was totally illiterate. But he knew more about the plants and animals of the Trinity River bottom than any naturalist I had ever met. I could walk through, he couldn't give you the Latin name of them, but we could walk through the Trinity River bottoms and he could tell me what every plant was, what it was good for, whether it was edible or not, whether it was poisonous or not. He could tell me about almost any animal that inhabited the Trinity River bottoms, who they preyed on, what their predators were, blah, blah, blah. He could have taught us, if he had had the proper clothes and the proper background, he could have made one heck of a professor teaching about the ecology of the Trinity River bottoms. He was one of the best educated men I ever met, although he was totally unschooled. End of class. We'll see you later.